Well, I appreciate the opportunity once again to be your teacher. We're glad that everyone's here. Some are back from their travels. We're glad to see them, and some visiting with us. We appreciate your presence. We're going to look at Matthew chapter 24, which is a continuation of the McGarvey Pendleton parallel gospels that we're studying. Gives us kind of a backdrop to understand the scriptures as we read through Matthew. It's kind of a help. I'm going to deviate just a little bit. My verses begin at Matthew 24, 29 through 51. The reason that break is there, because our brother last time taught the destruction of Jerusalem. And verse 29, according to McGarvey, he has certain ideas about how Matthew 24 continues concerning the second coming of Christ, hence the heading, as he put it, the second coming of Christ. Now, I'm going to deviate a little bit, and I'll show you where and why. Because in teaching this chapter, of course, you have to, as you do a study, you want to have a conviction about what you're teaching. And I couldn't quite mesh with what he was saying in a few verses. You're not going to see a big deviation. It's just where the transition takes place, and I'll explain that as we go. I have on the board a key passage that I believe unlocks the chapter. That'll be at Matthew 24, 34, where Jesus, in his discourse, points out, "This generation shall not pass away until," that's a time indicator, all these things that he had mentioned previously and that Jamie taught us on are fulfilled. So the word signs, I'm going to use as time indicators. And to keep it simple, where there are signs, there are indications concerning the destruction of Jerusalem. And where there are no signs, the second coming of Christ, that's where the transition takes place in verse 36. There are no time indicators, so that's where I'm going to make this transition. I'm going to read Matthew 24, beginning with verse 29 and down through the end of the chapter. The other two verses, Mark 13 and Luke 21, are on the board as references to help you in studying this, the other parallel verses. I'll not really get into those much. They're not going to add to or take away from anything I'm going to say in my time, as those things are already folded in. So I'll begin Matthew 24 and verse 29 on page 1142. "Immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light, the stars will fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he will send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds from one end of heaven to the other. Now learn this parable from the fig tree. When its branch has already become tender and puts forth leaves, you know that summer is near. So you also, when you see all these things, know that it is near at the doors. Assuredly, I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away till all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will by no means pass away. But of that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, but my Father only. But as the days of Noah were, so also will be the coming of the Son of Man be. For as in the days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying, giving in marriage, until the day that Noah entered the ark, and did not know until the floods came and took them all away, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be. Then two men will be in the field, one will be taken, the other left. Two women will be grinding at the mill, one will be taken and the other left. Watch therefore, for you do not know what hour your Lord is coming. But know this, that if the master of the house had known what hour the thief would come, he would have watched and not allowed his house to be broken into. Therefore, you also be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect. Who then is a faithful and wise servant whom his master made ruler over his household to give them food in due season? Blessed is that servant whom his master, when he comes, will find so doing. Assuredly, I say to you that he will make him ruler over all his goods. But if that evil servant says in his heart, my master is delaying his coming, and begins to beat his fellow servants and to eat and drink with the drunkards, the master of that servant will come on a day when he is not looking for him, and at an hour that he is not aware of, and will cut him in two and appoint him his portion with the hypocrites. There shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Now, some of the difficulties, of course, is the language, which is infused with apocalyptic language, and it refers back to Daniel 7, which Daniel 7, as we finished the book of Revelation, joins together Matthew and Revelation in what the destruction of Jerusalem is about, the Roman armies, and some details there in Revelation found in Daniel. That language is a little vague and it's hard to understand unless you look at it as apocalyptic language should be looked at, figuratively, until you're forced to take it literally. Basically, we study the Bible literally until we're forced to take it figuratively. So some of this language is a little strange. For instance, in the transition that I'm going to rely on, in verse 35, Jesus says, heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will no means pass away. That seems to me a strange thing to say in the middle of this. Why does he make that statement? Well, heaven and earth will pass away, and all the things before that were concerning heaven and earth, that is, destruction of Jerusalem, the temple, and the city itself by the Roman army. It was a temporary local prophecy that Daniel references that is going to be fulfilled. And he mentioned it in verse 34, assuredly I say to you, assuredly, emphasizing the truthfulness, the fact of this, I say to you, those he's speaking to at that time, this generation. And I take the position a little bit different than McGarvey does. The generation kind of refers to the culture of the Jews, and so it could span different amounts of time. I take it as Jesus' contemporaries, as Art and Gingrich do, and other basic Bible study helps, Bollinger and others who believe generation is a span of time. So the contemporaries of Jesus hearing this within about a 40-year span of time, AD 70, is going to be destruction of Jerusalem when Jesus was speaking. From the 30s to the 70s, that span of time would be that generation that will not die off, that will not pass, by no means pass away till all these things, until all these things happen, be fulfilled, take place. So here, to me, is a time indicator, because everything previous to this, and if you heard Jamie's study, was about signs. You'll see this, false Christ, false messiahs. You'll see here wars and rumors of wars. There'll be political conflict, the Roman armies and others, and you'll hear all of this, and there'll be those who will lose their faith, those who will be weak in their faith. These clues and signs were determining the time of Jerusalem's fall by AD 70. So Christ gave them these signs to watch for false messiahs, Christ. They're going to come about and say this, don't believe them, don't follow them. Now, the Bible doesn't give us examples of that, but historians do, such as Josephus and others, that there were false messiahs trying to take that political reign that Jesus was never here for. His was going to be a spiritual kingdom. He mentions a numerous military encounter, something you could see, something that would happen in a span of time. It would be famines and earthquakes, something you could see and feel. Time indicator, disciples would be persecuted in that span of time, heavy persecution, the disciples would be killed. So that was another sign. Those departing from the faith, you could see that. False prophets would come. Some saints would become unfaithful. Those who endured till the end of the destruction of Jerusalem will endure. Those who escaped and took heed of the signs that Jesus gave them. And finally, the gospel proclaimed for the for the whole world. Of course, that would be the world they understood, not the world that we see, because our world didn't exist then. So the world that existed then, geographically, the limits of the whole world, the gospel was proclaimed as the Jews' covenant with God was now ceasing, as Jesus, the Son of Man, was bringing it to a close, as he did on the cross. And realize when Jesus says Son of Man, every time that reference is in here, it's always Jesus saying that about himself. No one ever calls Jesus the Son of Man but Jesus. Daniel referred to one like the Son of Man, referring to Jesus. Daniel was the only one in the Old Testament, New Testament. Nobody calls Jesus the Son of Man, but Jesus does. So that's a reference he uses. In this text, you find it used for the destruction of Jerusalem, Jesus coming figuratively, and you find it Jesus coming literally using the Son of Man. It would have been easier if it said, when the Lord comes, versus when the Son of Man comes, making one show the difference. So they're used interchangeably. The coming of the Lord, the coming of the Son of Man is interchangeably, but by the context, I have to limit it to everything above my transition. Verse 34 is, if you see the Son of Man coming there, it's figurative. That language is being used for destruction of Jerusalem. When it talks about Jesus being on his throne, and they would see that, it's talking about Jesus directing, orchestrating this Roman army and destruction of Jerusalem, this prophecy of Daniel and other prophecies that said that this would happen. So when he's on his throne there, it's a figurative representation of Christ on his throne. He's been on his throne, remember, from the cross. He's seated at David's throne. That's a political, spiritual throne over Christ's church, a little bit different than this throne, which is the throne of wrath and judgment. And then finally, there's another throne that comes at the end of the picture when he talks about at the end of the chapter, those who are unfaithful will be have their portion with the hypocrites, weeping and gnashing of teeth. We understand that as final judgment. Now, I've sprinkled some things here, and I'm going to go back and give this a little bit more in line with how it flows. But understand, it's a controversial book. A lot of our religious friends have premillennialism borrowed from this and other books of the Bible. But that's a mess. I've always found if a denomination or someone wants to teach you about prophecy, you go to the basics of how to be saved. And if they can't get that right, it's going to be hard for them to get something as difficult as prophecy is. So that's, to me, always a red flag when they're selling books on premillennialism and what Matthew 24's involvement is. And that was advice from Johnny Olmore on how to distinguish some of those things early on. And so he gave good advice. There are scholars who differ on where the transition happens, such as McGarvey. And as I said, my conviction is based on what I understand, and so I'm giving you what I understand on this. Now, Chad will have the next chapter, which actually draws into a little bit, because there's two parables there now. He may teach beyond what I need from there, but the two references in Matthew 25, of course, as chapters are man-made, actually is a flow of this, and they explain this part of my lesson. So what we're concerned about is the second coming of Christ. And the question that the disciples ask in the early part of the chapter is kind of a setup to the context. And I'll just read that in Matthew 24, 1. Then Jesus went out, departed from the temple, and disciples came to him to show the buildings of the temple. Jesus said to them, "Do you not see all these things?" He's talking about the physicality of the holy temple and Jerusalem itself that they were so proud of and wanting to show Jesus. "Assuredly, I say to you, not one stone shall be left here upon another that shall not be thrown down." Now, this is a shocking, confusing statement to them. Verse 3, "Now, as he sat on the Mount of Olives, disciples came to him privately, saying, 'Tell us, when will these things be? And what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age?'" How many questions did they ask him? Some say two, some say three, some say one. That was threefold or twofold. I don't know what's in their mind, what they were thinking, end of the age, end of the world. Were they combining it? Were they asking separate things? Since I don't know exactly what they meant, I can only go with how Jesus answered them. And I find that Jesus split this this context into two things: destruction of Jerusalem, my transition, second coming of Christ. And he explains these with the fig tree parable that sums up earlier his teaching. And I'll show you how this happens. So Jesus gave these clues, signs, time indicators, keep that in mind, to determine the time of Jerusalem's fall. So they would have all these signs, these things to help them along to discover when this was happening, that this was happening because Jesus gave them all these signs. These must happen first, he said. Then, at the second coming of man, that day, previous, these things, it seems to be all plural. These things that are happening, all these things, this generation won't pass until all these things were fulfilled. Then of that day, seems to be a contrast. There won't be any signs, and we'll see by the examples. And Jesus says himself, he didn't know. Angels of heaven don't know. I don't know when that day comes, only the Father. That seems to be a very bold statement based on what he did know about the signs he gave them, the indicators of what to look for. So there is a transition here. Where is it exactly? I'll leave that up to you, but this is where I make my transition. So in this context, in this discourse, there's two major parts: destruction of Jerusalem, the signs related to that event from verses 4 through 34. Part two is Jesus addresses his second coming by the lack of signs, verses 35 through 51. The signs are found in Matthew 4 through 14, all fulfilled within a 40-year time span between Jesus' discourse and destruction of Jerusalem by 70 AD. There's, as I said, major hints, key verses that prove signs relate to the destruction of Jerusalem. This generation shall not pass away till all these things be fulfilled. These is referring to the signs, these time indicators that would be accomplished before that generation passed. Artin Gingrich says the Greek word genea, G-E-N-E-A, generation, refers to the sum total of those born at the same time, expanded to include all living at the time of, at a given time, generation. That those of Christ's contemporaries, those people hearing him, that's what he's talking about. That's the view I take of generation. Because if you change and alter the definition of those words, you can get in the woods. And so to stay out of the woods and to try to stay clear as how Jesus is answering this, I believe it fits the best. There are no signs giving the second coming of Christ, no sign indicators. How do I know that? Well, by the example he gives. The first example is Noah's flood. People would be continuing on life as business as usual until the day the flood came. They were eating, marrying, giving in marriage, unaware. The proclamation was by Noah, but maybe they weren't listening. The availability of the gospel of Noah was there. He was trying to preach it by his action, and probably he spoke it. I don't know what all he did. Today, we're not going to reach everybody with the gospel, but we have the obligation and responsibility to try. So it's never about every single person hearing the gospel. It's the availability of it. And so at that time, in that existent world, it was preached. And of course, Peter and Paul speak to that, that the gospel was taught into all the world, or taken to all the world, or available. So in Noah's flood is the first example. They were unaware. Business as usual. So shall be the coming of the Son of Man. So it's a different coming of the Son of Man as previous in verses up to 29 or verses 34 that had signs. This has no related signs, no indicators, unaware. The second example is Sodom. People of that city unaware of the pending disaster until the day that Lot went out from Sodom. Even so, after the same manner shall the in the day of the Son of Man. It's related to Luke 17. So then he uses the thief. And then we know that he's mentioned as a thief, analogous to a thief in the way that a thief is unaware. In no other way is he related to a thief. But Jesus said he would come at an unexpected time, just as a thief does. You find that also in 1 Thessalonians 5:2, 2 Peter 3:10. So here in Matthew 24, 43, and 44, he uses the example of a thief who comes unaware. He doesn't come announced. So Jesus' second coming isn't going to be something you're going to be able to see by signs. No time indicators. Unaware. So he's talking about leading us to being prepared and being ready, because that's what it is all about. The summation is to be ready, be prepared. How do you get prepared and be ready without signs, without time indicators? Because many people in the faith fail over time, as we see in the text of those who say delaying is coming. And from being a faithful servant, they become an evil or unfaithful servant. Well, it was mentioned to us this morning by Eric in his good lesson about the peace that we can only get from Christ, that we can have peace and work towards peace. Of course, that comes by means of the gospel and being a Christian. So we'll find those are the first steps of being prepared, is to be ready for Christ, believing in Christ, understanding that his coming is what we're waiting for, even though we don't know when. We aren't date setters. Well, he uses a fourth example, unexpected hour. And that's going to be later. Chad will deal with that. The parables of the virgins and the talents teaches the second coming, I believe. And we'll let Chad deal with some of that if he does. And he may have a lot more to say about that. So Jesus basically gives no signs to show the end of the world. So I think either Jesus knows what their question is, and that's why he answers it the way he does, or they didn't understand what they were asking, and so he answers it, making the differentiation, so they will understand. Because I believe it's best for me not to try to figure out what they're asking, but go with what Jesus said. He knew their hearts, he knew how to answer them, so I go with what he said. And to me, the flow is this separation. But of that day and hour knoweth no one, not even the angels, neither the Son, but the Father only. So he knew about the signs, he knew about the destruction, he knew about the prophecy of Daniel. In the beginning of Matthew, what happened? John the Baptist came on the scene. What did he say to the Pharisees? He called them brood of vipers, snakes. Who warned you to flee from the wrath to come? Which leads us all through Matthew until this point. The wrath to come was God's wrath upon Jerusalem for killing the Messiah, rejecting him and killing him on the cross. That's what this led up to. It was prophesied that would happen. He gave them warning. John the Baptist asking a rhetorical question. Who warned you? Well, the prophets warned you. That's why they're coming to his baptism, because they self-justification. We're good. Let us be baptized too. He said, no, you need to bring forth fruits meet for repentance. The axe is laid at the root of the trees. The judgment was beginning when Christ was born. To accept the Messiah or reject him. That's what this is all about. And it comes to the cross in Matthew 24. So the second coming and judgment day are one and the same. The second coming of the Son of Man, which is literal, and that happens in my transition after verse 34. The first is figurative. Anytime you see the coming of the Son of Man, it's figurative. It's the apocalyptic language concerning God's wrath on Israel. After this, it's global. Before, it's local, limited to Jerusalem. After this, it's global, it's universal. And so the second coming and judgment day happen at the same time. The second coming is the judgment day. The second coming is when we will be with Christ eternally. And so that's why he gives that warning at the end of the chapter of those who will be, if they're found unfaithful, there'll be weeping and gnashing of teeth. That's a point concerning judgment. So I think that in understanding this, if you use those time indicators, those signs that he talked about, beginning in verse 29, immediately after, tribulation, those days, time indicators. Tribulation is the sign, those days, immediately after. This throws people off, because the immediately after, what does immediate mean? Well, it means one thing to us, not necessarily in prophetic language, the same thing as it meant when Jesus said it. Immediately after the tribulation of those days. If we take it at face value, it would be associated and closely tied with the destruction of Jerusalem. If we put immediately as many, many years, doesn't seem to make sense. So by context, by its flow, it is connected with the destruction of Jerusalem. Tribulation. Tribulation means hardship. Those days. Sun darken. Moon not give its light. Stars will fall from heaven. Powers of heavens will be shaken. Very similar to Daniel's apocalyptic language. So this is talking about, I believe, fulfillment of prophecy connected to Daniel, Revelation, and other scriptures. The fulfillment of the Old Testament prophecy about destruction of Jerusalem. Verse 30, the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven. This, I believe, is figurative. This, I believe, is God orchestrating from heaven the sign of the Son of Man in heaven. When all the tribes of the earth will mourn, they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. I don't believe that that is the second coming. This is still under structure in Jerusalem. It's figurative, relating to the vision of Christ who is behind this, who has, this has been the prophecy, this is the wrath of God, this is the destruction, this came from heaven, this is the authority. And so the Son of Man, which is used figuratively, literally for the second coming, figuratively for destruction of Jerusalem, Son of Man phrase throws people off. Verse 31, send his angels, great sound of a trumpet, gather together elect from the four winds, one end of heaven to the other. Then he gives the parable of the fig tree. Now learn this parable from the fig tree. Another time indicator. When its branch has already become tender, puts forth its leaves, you know that summer is near. Now this is something they would know as they were closer to nature than a lot of us are. This is how they measured seasons. And so it's an indicator of time that they would recognize as an example. Verse 33, so you also, when you see all these things, these other sign indicators that the fig tree is related to and showing you these things building up, these seasons of tribulation, of hardships, know that it is near at the doors. What is? The abomination of desolation, destruction of Jerusalem, the end of that covenant in its fulfillment. Verse 34, surely I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away till all these things take place. That's why I make my split right there. To me, that makes more sense. McGarvey relates some things a little bit differently there in his transition. Doesn't matter, really, as long as we understand, I believe, and I agree with McGarvey, destruction of Jerusalem, second coming of Christ, transition, that's what Jesus teaches. The truth about this, the truth about that, and they're different. One has time indicators, the other does not. Well, one of the things he emphasizes is to watch. Verse 42, watch therefore, for you do not know what hour your Lord is coming. Well, if we had signs like they did earlier, we could watch, we could know. But the example is, if that of his master of the house had known when the thief would come, he would have watched. Well, we don't want to sit around watching for a thief at a house. So what is he talking about? How do we watch for Christ? It's very easy. Obey the gospel, be faithful till death. Do the business of a Christian, do the business of the church. That is spiritual watching. At your house, you don't have to be there to set up cameras, alarms. Some people put in posters, this house is guarded by ADT security. I have a Smith & Wesson, beware of dog. Whether they do or not, people can put these things up to deter burglars. You can enforce your house, you can make your doors solid. Everything, alarm systems, cameras, and be away. But you prepared your house. So the thief is going to see that and hopefully be deterred, a real thief. But Christ is a thief, coming unaware, in that sense only. Jesus will come unaware. How do you prepare? Well, spiritually, you obey the gospel. You're a Christian. You're prepared there, and you remain prepared by being faithful. So the preparation is, you're always ready, because you have the security of Christ. That's what it means to be saved. You're saved because you're secured by Christ's blood. What he did, you understand and accept him as the Messiah. And so you don't have to have time indicators and such. Even Christ said he didn't know that time, or at least in the flesh, as the Son of Man is used, he's referencing that. How that works, I don't really know, but that's what he said. So we have Noah's flood, the overthrow of Sodom like a thief, unexpected hour. I believe we can see all these things show us that that is a different thing. Well, lastly, and I think I've hashed that enough, I just want to say this. When the Son of Man comes, there's basically three things. You know, a lot of people speculate when he's going to return. No time indicators. That's what I've teaching here today. With respect to the second coming, judgment day, which are simultaneous. So the focus is, what we want to take from this lesson is to be prepared, because it's going to be unexpected. When the Son of Man comes, the first thing he's going to do is going to sit. When the Son of Man comes, he will sit on his glorious throne. You might say, well, isn't he already sitting on the throne of David? Yes, he's going to sit on something else here, the judgment throne. Is it the same throne? Probably. Is it a throne at all? I don't know. Probably not. But that's the language. He's going to sit and judge. Christ is going to sit and judge. So the first thing he comes at the second coming is sit. And humanity better be ready. The second thing, when the Son of Man comes, he will separate. He said at the end of the chapter, they will join, have their portion with the hypocrites, those who are unfaithful. Those who are faithful, of course, will join Christ in eternity. This happens at the judgment, the separation of the sheep and goats. All nations will be gathered. Separation will occur. That's global. So when he returns for judgment, all are commanded to repent, for he'll judge the world in righteousness, Acts 17, 30 and 31. There'll be a great division. It's going to be universal. And lastly, when the Son of Man comes, after he sits, separates, he's going to say. What will he say? Verses 37 through 45, the truths of the judgment day. We shouldn't conclude from these verses that will be any more literal than the sheep are literal and the goats are literal on the left and right hand. But this dialogue that God has, or Jesus has, with the sheep and goats portrays the lessons, of course, of being prepared. To those on the right, he'll say, come, you who are blessed of my Father. To be blessed of the Father means these sheep are saved. And they'll receive mercy, and they'll escape God's wrath. So the first wrath was destruction of Jerusalem, but there's another wrath coming. God has to deal with sin, and that's going to be in the great judgment. He will say, verse 46, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. Eternity begins with us in God's presence. The word inherit means they take rightful possession, and that's what he said. He'll make us rulers over his household. We're going to share with God in a way that we never have. Now, that's amazing to me. The peace that Eric talked about is a peace that no one can take. You can give it away. But if you have God's peace in your heart from the gospel, through the gospel, the peace with Christ, then you have that peace that helps you patiently await the second coming. You have a possession awaiting you, whatever it means to have this mansion, to be in God's presence. This new beginning is a beginning of eternity that we'll have with God that we don't quite have now. It's going to be a little different. And I don't have words to express it because I don't know how to explain how great that will be. But that's why we wait for the second coming. That's why we're prepared, and that's why we watch. There's more that I could say, but I think this suffices to keep it as simple as I could to make these transitions as I see. Hopefully you see those the same. If not, stick with McGarvey Pendleton. He's pretty close too. But there's really no controversy there as to what this is about. So again, the invitation for you to have peace with Christ, for you to be ready to believe, repent, confess, and be baptized. If you've done that, if you've made the gospel, if you need assistance in any other way for us to pray with you and for you, won't you come while we stand and sing?